Here on Radio 4 FM, it's our Book of the Week. Rebecca Front reads the final instalment from Curious, a collection of memories and observations that explore all that is fascinating about everyday life. Today, she lifts the lid on the mysterious world of celebrity.
I took my husband Phil to a swanky restaurant for his birthday. He is, let me point out, a hugely generous man, except where food is concerned. His view is, if you want a thing, you should order it in the first place. Thus, anything he orders will follow a clear and inevitable trajectory from his plate to his mouth, and woe betide you if you try to reroute it towards your own. Anyway, midway through dinner, a shimmer of cashmere and a breeze of exquisite scent brushed past our table, and when I saw an elegant hand reaching down to swipe one of Phil's chips, I fully expected him to spear it with his steak knife. But instead, he gazed upward with a serene smile at the retreating form of Lauren Bacall. I'd like to have put his passivity down to shock, but the fact was that there was one rule for screen goddesses and another rule for the mother of your children. It was his birthday and I didn't want to start a fight, so I tried instead to pretend that I had planned the whole thing as a surprise. And the more I thought about it, the more amazed I was that no one had come up with it before. Thrill your loved one by getting a celebrity to whip some food off their plate. The chippogram, I suppose you could call it. The truth was, though, that Ms. Bacall, Betty, as I feel I can call her now that she's on such intimate terms with my husband's dinner, had clearly learnt from her long years of fame that whatever a star says or does, however bland the comment or trivial the gesture, they're providing a snapshot that we ordinary mortals will treasure for the rest of our lives. Merely by being in the same room as someone, a star can reduce that person to incoherent jelly. Being an actor, I get to meet famous people pretty often, and being an idiot, I frequently respond badly. After the first performance of a Stephen Sondheim musical I was in many years ago, I was introduced to the composer, something of a hero of mine. Unfortunately, my director, who'd made the introduction, mentioned that I also write songs. Politeness demanded, therefore, that Sondheim, legendary lyricist of West Side Story, had to talk songwriting with me, author of some comedy ditties for Radio 4. "So what's your starting point for a composition?" he asked me. I blinked at him. "What's your process?" he persevered, charmingly pretending to be interested. I was tongue-tied with terror. "I have no process. I can't even read music. What could I possibly say about my process that would make Stephen Sondheim rub his chin and say, 'Wow, that's really interesting. I must try it myself sometime.'" I said the only thing I could think of. I mean, it's like kind of crosswords. But I said it less coherently.
"Crosswords?
In what way?" the great man persisted.
"Well, sort of not many words, you know, to get your ideas across."
"In that," he ventured, he really wanted to help me out here, "in that there are parts blanked out in your head that you need to fill." It was my turn to look confused. And then the realization struck me.
"Sonnets," I blurted.
"Sonnets?" said Sondheim.
"When I said crosswords, I meant sonnets."
"Right," he replied, and did that thing where you pretend you've spotted someone over the far side of the room and leave. And I couldn't blame him. He'd more than fulfilled the duty of a famous person. He had given me a moment in his company that I will never forget, however much therapy I have. Now, it would be disingenuous of me to ignore the fact that acting has not only brought me close to the famous, but closer to being famous than if I'd carried on working, as I used to, in a perfume shop. But I'm a million miles away from Lauren Bacall's high-class scavenger status. The whole spectrum of being known and not being known affords ample opportunities for looking ridiculous. I went into a shop near my house one morning, and the owner, who sees me several times a week and always has a brief chat, said, "Didn't I see you last night?"
My first thought, I'm ashamed to admit, was that if something I'd filmed a long time before had been repeated, there might be a bit of money coming my way. So trying to hide the avaricious glint in my eye, I said, "Oh, possibly. What was that in?" She looked at me, puzzled by the curious phrasing of my question, and then said, "In the street." I left the shop, quietly hating myself. Worse still is when someone knows they know you, but can't quite remember where from. You have to decide how long to leave them guessing before venturing that they might, possibly, have seen you on the telly. The problem with this is that it feels so, well, showy. Firstly, it's entirely possible that they actually do know you and you've just forgotten. But secondly, if they agree that they haven't met you before, they'll ask you what they've seen you in. Like that character from The Simpsons who always introduces himself by saying, "You may know me from such shows as..." There's something pathetically undignified about trotting out your CV in the street. That fame is a transient state is obvious, in that you can drop out of the public eye at any time. But what is less apparent is that you can literally be famous one minute and not the next. Every so often, if you're in a programme that's nominated for an award, say, you have to do the red carpet walk of shame. That's what it feels like anyway, because unless you're at least a face, and better still, a name, you won't see a single flashbulb aimed at you. To the massed ranks of photographers, you are merely a chance to change lenses. Once, after many years of scuttling towards the entrance head down, feigning conversation with the person behind me, I was pleasantly surprised when my arrival was greeted with a barrage of calls of, "Over here, love!" I obliged by looking their way with a modest yet cheekbone-enhancing smile. "Over here, love!" the calls continued, getting louder and more insistent. So I stood still, trying to remember that pose that makes you look like you have endless legs and tiny hips, rather than the other way round. "Move over here, love!" a photographer shouted, with some irritation this time. "You're blocking Honor Blackman!" So when, some years after this, I was nominated for an award myself, I approached the Walk of Shame, assuming that it would be the same old humiliating ritual. What I had innocently failed to realise is that the whole red carpet thing is managed by PR people. The photographers know who to shout for because someone tells them. So for the first time, I was expected. They called my name, I tried the pose, they took a few pictures, and then a PR person led me inside the venue. Now it happened that I won that night, and in order to go and celebrate this unexpected turn of events, I had to run the gauntlet of another red carpet. I still wasn't a face or a name, but now I was a winner, all the photographers took pictures of me. I was there for what seemed like an age, doing interviews and posing with the award and without it. It was, I freely confess it, completely intoxicating. I went inside to the party, and when I emerged, there were photographers there too. Since I had, merely 2 hours earlier, been the object of so much attention, I duly stopped and posed for them again. Nothing. Nada. Just the eerily reminiscent sound of lenses being unscrewed. I'd gone in there a star and come back a nobody. It was a sobering experience. None of this truly matters, of course, but for one pragmatic concern. The more famous you are, the better parts you get offered. So there are times when I have to do things that will, to use agent speak, enhance my public profile. To this end, I once agreed to go to one of those Christmas celebrity audience shows. You know the kind of thing. A TV personality introduces TV clips to an audience of other TV personalities. When I got the invitation, I was, I confess, flattered that my name was even on that kind of list. And it was a plus one, which meant a night out with Phil, so I saw no reason to turn it down. When we arrived outside the studio, a hassled woman with a clipboard had to check everyone's invitations. The fact that this took so long should have rung alarm bells. If the guest list was as star-studded as had been suggested, surely they wouldn't all need to have their identities confirmed.
I don't imagine George Clooney has to blow his hands warm while someone asks him if he has any form of ID. Once we got inside, I looked around to see who was there. But the mere fact of my being on the guest list should have given me an indication of how low rent an affair this was. There were more dancing weather presenters than you could shake a stick at, and no shortage of people who are famous for telling other people that their houses are dirty and their children obese. I did bump into one very gifted young actress of my acquaintance. "Hey," I said, delighted to recognise someone at last. "How's it going?" "Not great. I'm between jobs at the moment," she replied, and carried on serving cocktail sausages. We were all eventually ushered through to the studio so that recording could begin. Phil and I found our allocated seats. Front row centre, pretty impressive. Stuck behind the presenter's monitor, not so good. You go to these things to see and be seen. If there's no one you want to see, and no chance of getting on camera, it starts to look like a waste of an evening. An official-looking man with a headset came over and suggested we might like to move to get a better view. Also, there was a gap in the middle that they needed to fill. A minibus full of ordinary people from an ordinary town who'd been in a documentary about how ordinary they were and consequently become very famous indeed had got stuck in traffic. We stood up and began to move when someone else in a headset asked us where we were going. I explained that we'd been asked to fill the empty seats. "Who told you to move? Do you actually have seats?" she barked, as if people were forever walking in off the streets in evening gowns and lip gloss and getting past four security checks just in the hope of meeting a daytime TV money expert. Before I could lose my temper, Phil stepped in. "Actually, don't worry," he said, as she stood scanning the list of names, doubtful that we could possibly be on it. "I know exactly where we should be sitting." He took my hand and led me out of the studio. Where we should have been sitting was at home on the sofa eating a takeaway, and 30 minutes later, we were. That night taught me a valuable lesson. If you need to be surrounded by celebrities to confirm your worth, you probably want to take a good long look at what you've turned into. Being famous may get you more of the things you want out of life, better job opportunities, more money, posh nights out, but it won't, or it shouldn't, make you feel you deserve them. When children say that they want more than anything to be famous, I wonder if what they really mean is successful. But you can be successful in countless ways that don't include fame. Or perhaps they mean they want to feel validated, envied, or loved. Well, I'd argue that only the last of these is worth putting any real effort into. Fame gives you a certain power, I suppose. And if you're smart, you'll use that judiciously, not by throwing your weight around, but by putting it behind things that matter. But take it from someone who's been famous for whole moments at a time. Fame is like going through an unexpectedly mild patch in a swimming pool. It fleetingly bathes you in a warm glow, then makes you feel a little bit grubby. Of course, it must be glamorous to be one of the Bacalls of this world. But it must also make it damn difficult having a drink with your mates, popping to the chemists, buying underwear. It must mean forfeiting a normal life. And that seems an awfully high price to pay for a free chip.
Rebecca Front was reading from her book Curious, True Stories and Loose Connections. The book was abridged by Sarah Davies and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And for more exclusive content on this week's Book of the Week, you can go to the BBC Radio 4 website. Now, recent figures suggest that a third of women are not using any contraception at all, and the majority of them are said to be in their 30s and 40s with degrees and mortgages. But is it a considered lifestyle choice or just crazy risk-taking? Plus football, Father's Day and Miss World. It's all in Woman's Hour after the news.